All right, good morning, golfers. Welcome to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Thank you for joining me. It's a little chilly this morning, but and we had some technical difficulties this morning, but we're going to get right to John Huggan, who's on the line. John, how you doing, John?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good, good. Some dialing issues, but we're good to go now. Thank you for joining me.
Anytime.
Wanted to start with the, I don't know if you, we're in the middle of the wraparound tour, just, you know, in this whole idea. I just wanted to know if you, given the amount of times that we've done it now, can you wrap your brain around this wraparound tour season?
Well, the European Tour were first to indulge in this nonsense. I mean, it clearly, it doesn't make any sense from a, you know, just a purely statistical point of view. It makes things really awkward.
Right.
It seems to me that we're doing this because of the rank and file on both tours.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them somewhere to play. I mean, golf ideally would benefit, or professional golf would ideally benefit, I think, from some kind of off-season, at least a month, where there's no golf being played anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all need a break at some point. We're not getting that because the guys that nobody pays to turn up and see are running the show on both sides of the Atlantic. So basically, I think that this is happening to give them somewhere to play and somewhere to earn some money when the stars are taking time off.
Yeah, and when you mentioned the time off, and I get what they're trying to do and trying to employ as many people for as long as possible. That the only thing about the off season in terms of golf, and maybe golf in some ways from a marketing standpoint doesn't want to disappear and then reemerge. But, you know, golf, even when the off season, we don't have a transfer window, you know. We don't have the NFL draft build up. But, you know, there's no trades going on. There's none of that. When we disappear, we disappear. And to me, it seems like part of it also is that they would like to keep, you know, golf in the, you know, somewhere in the news, even as little as possible.
Well, there is that, but I mean, you mentioned the NFL. I mean, in your country right now, I mean, I can't imagine that too many sports fans are paying much attention to golf anyway,
right?
Whether it's there or not. The NFL markets itself in a terrific way, I think, in the sense that they have a fairly short season. There's a distinct, you know, there's a time of year when there's nothing going on, there's no games,
mm-hmm.
which makes every game in the NFL special.
Yep.
And the trouble with golf is that, you know, the tournament that's going on this week has got nothing really to recommend it other than there'll be another one just like it next week. And that, to me, makes me lethargic in terms of watching, and I'm sure that the casual fan is even worse in that respect.
Yeah, no, you make a good point, and I think, I think that's why part of the Masters is so, I think, people in people's minds, because they've just basically, you know, suffered through some sort of winter particularly in the Northeast here and a lot of the parts of the world. But it's, it's cold, and we're ready for the warmth, and we're ready for the first major of the year. So we're all sort of chomping at the bit, you know.
Well, that's right. I mean, then you mentioned the Masters is genius, the way the Masters is marketed.
Yeah.
I mean, Peter Thomson, the five-time Open champion, once said to me that the Masters is the biggest con job in sports, which might be a little bit strong, but it's fantastic the way that they've done it. I mean, it's really, if you think about it logically, it's got no business being one of the four most important events in the game. I mean, it's run by a private club that doesn't let anybody in for 51 weeks of the year.
Right.
And it's not really the image that golf, you know, if it wants to grow the famous phrase, grow the game, if you want to grow the game, I mean, places like Augusta National are the worst possible examples of that. But the Masters, having said all that, is a terrific event. I mean, it's fantastic to watch. And as you say, the time of year is hugely beneficial. The Northern Hemisphere is coming out of a long winter and is gagging for some golf in early April, and they certainly made the most of it. The money, you can only imagine how much money the Augusta National makes on the Masters every year.
I'm sure it's somewhere in the realm of obscene, if I could use a word.
Yeah, or even worse than that.
Well, given the short window, if you will, for looking back at the 2015 season. How would you put that in perspective historically in terms of entertainment value, the emergence of players? What are your thoughts when you reflect back on last season?
Oh, well, I think it's got to be top 10. I would have to say that we've had three players emerge with, you know, they're substantially better than the rest, it would seem to me. Ricky Fowler is a distant fourth behind Day, Spieth, and McIlroy. And McIlroy, you know, made a mess of his season in terms of, you know, went out and played football, soccer in your language, and cost himself a month at exactly the wrong time of the year. Had he played in that month in the Scottish Open, the Open, and I think the Bridgestone was the other one he missed, given his past record in those events, I think he would still be number one in the world, because you'd have to think he would have contended in at least one of those, if not more. And no matter how well Spieth and Day did, and my goodness, they had remarkable years, the two of them, I think McIlroy would still be ranked number one if he performed decently when he was off. But we'll never really know that, of course, but
sure.
I mean, year is extraordinary. But Day, I was talking to Hank Haney the other day for a newspaper piece for Tomorrow, and he came out with all these statistics, as Hank does, and Day's year is best of all of the three,
right,
statistically. But, I mean, having said that, of course, if you ask Jason Day, whose year would you rather have, your own or Jordan Spieth's, he would obviously say Spieth, because Spieth won two majors. But the two of them, plus Rory, and throw in Fowler on a slightly lower level, he won three huge events all over the place. We're very fortunate right now. We've not got, you can argue back and forth whether it's better if we have a dominant player or we don't have a dominant player, but I like the fact that we've got a little bit of a rivalry going, and they're from different places as well. We've got one from Australia, one from Ireland, and one from America, which I think is ideal. I mean, I'm firmly of the opinion that the professional tours need to be more outward-looking, and ideally, of course, we bang on about this every now and again, but ideally there should be some kind of world tour going on. It's the tours themselves are run as businesses, which is, you know, to be expected, but morally, at least, if you put it that way, they owe the game, I think, some kind of world tour. It would be far better, it would be entertaining, and we could have tours from America, Europe, Asia, all the rest, feeding into the big tour, if you like. And I think that would be fantastic to watch, and I think that would, you know, to go back to that famous phrase, grow the game, I think that would be the ideal scenario.
Sure. And to your spot on, I think, mentioned that thing about Jason Day and his year statistically. I mean, I'm not a fantasy golf person, but if you were a fantasy golf person, how are you not picking Jason Day every week? I mean, especially in the majors. And that his performance in the majors, he seemed to be, if you tracked it, it had been on an upward rise for quite some time, and he suffered through some injuries. Like it's hard to imagine where he would be had he not suffered the number of injuries he's had to this point.
Well, that's right. That's the one question mark everyone would have about Jason Day is his body going to, you know, hold up enough for him to have the sort of career that he looks like he could have? I mean, you look at his swing, and, you know, my goodness, there's not much to go wrong there. There's not many moving parts, which
sure.
is always a thing, I always think. And it's the same with the other two. I mean, the great thing is they play differently. I mean, Jason Day plays, he's a bit similar to Rory, but Rory's kind of more up and down. I mean, you never quite know what you're going to get with Rory, which I like. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, he can be absolutely fantastic. I think his best golf is the best of the three, but he doesn't always perform at that level. And then you've got Spieth, who plays golf better than the other two.
Right.
He doesn't swing the club better, you know, whatever orthodox means in terms of swing technique, but he knows how to score, and he's certainly, he's by a mile, the best putter in the world right now. It might not show up in the statistics as number one, but if you were to ask anybody, I think, who would you like to hole a 12-foot putt to save your life, I think everybody would pick Jordan Spieth.
Yeah, I would. You can. My hand is raised. That's for sure. And it just goes to the point that there's, you know, the difference between golf swing and golf score. And getting the ball in the hole is definitely Jordan Spieth's strength. He sort of knows how to score like anybody.
Yeah, I mean, he's not been that great at match play so far, but he's got the ideal game for match play in that he doesn't miss that many putts and doesn't give that much encouragement to the opponent. I would hate to play against somebody like him far more than Rory. I mean, you'd have days where, you know, Rory would beat you 7-6, but there'd be other days where you'd have a wee chance.
Sure.
But against Jordan Spieth, I mean, you'd have to go out and beat him every time because he's just going to give you nothing.
If you put the season in the top 10, then let's drill down on the season. And if you look at the majors, the four majors, historically, and even from a historical value and a entertainment value, where would you put these four majors last season in perspective?
You want them in order?
Sure.
Cool. Well, I think the last hour of the hour and a half, say, of Chambers Bay, much as I had some, like most people, I think that I had some reservations over the venue. I mean, that to me was the most compelling 90 minutes of the season.
Yeah.
When Day was involved, but Spieth was up there and Dustin Johnson, of course, and Brandon Grace as well. I mean, there was all kinds of things going on there, and Spieth's win at the Masters would be probably second just for its historical significance. I think he might even reach double figures, which is a pretty good benchmark, I think, in terms of major wins these days. And probably Day winning the PGA would be next. It's taken Day quite a wee while to figure out how to get it done at that level. I mean, he's had a few, you know, I was making a joke with a friend of mine that you can almost guarantee that he'll be T4 at the end of every week in the majors, but hopefully that trend has changed with his win in the PGA. And I think our Open, for all it was terrific, it was kind of spoiled for me by the RNA's insistence on having the greens too fast and then telling us that it's to do with the slopes on the greens and all that kind of nonsense. It's nothing to do with the slopes on the... If we get wind like we can over here, you cannot have the greens running at 12 or whatever they normally have in professional tournaments, certainly in America.
Yeah, and Spieth was out there for that time.
It was decided that slow greens are bad.
Right. No, I agree, and Spieth was out there when they threw them out there, and I believe made bogey, if I'm not mistaken. Not that to net, you know, it's too much to connect the dots in a four-round tournament, but he was out there, and he did make bogey.
Yes, I mean, the whole thing was compromised by that however many minutes they were out there. It was two or three holes that some of them played, but it was a complete nonsense, and not because the greens at St. Andrews are too slopey or this or that, is because they were too fast.
Right.
I mean, I struggle to remember Opens back in the day at St. Andrews where they had to stop because it was too windy. I mean, this is a modern phenomenon, and it's all because of this obsession with fast greens, which I've never quite understood.
No, and we'd have some far more, I would think, interesting green complexes if we could just slow it down just a tad.
Well, absolutely, and I'm not saying that they should never have fast greens. I think they should mix it up. I mean, there's no doubt I bang on about this enough, but one of my main criticisms of especially the PGA Tour and increasingly the European Tour is the sameness of the challenge every week. I mean, the greens are the same speed, the bunkers are the sand's the same depth, the rough's the same length, the fairways are the same width. I mean, come on, we should be mixing it up a bit more, should we not?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, we want to challenge them in some way, and if you're not going to roll the ball back, and then you're going to have to find some more creative ways to challenge players. But, you know, as you know, as anybody else, I mean, money talks, and these guys are playing for a lot of money, and, you know, the rank and file are trying to make a living, and until somebody really stands up and says, you know, if people start to feel maybe they're losing interest in terms of an entertainment value, I fear nothing is going to change.
Well, you're probably right. I mean, but the old argument, do you think that competitive sport should be a democracy?
Well,
I don't. It should be the ultimate dog-eat-dog environment, and if you can't survive, you're gone, and that's how it should be.
Well, I think too much money has been made at the lower level, if you will, or the ranking, too much in the rank and file, that now there's a large group of numbers who have a pretty big voice. But to your point,
that's right. I mean, I don't know about you, but I look at the money list at the end of each year, and without coming up with any names in particular, I look down the list and I think, where did that guy win $3 million?
right.
It completely passes me by, but he's there. He's won $3 million, and probably without even contending properly for victories. And that's the problem, is that too many of them can make an incredible living without ever really putting themselves under real pressure.
Yeah. No, it's definitely interesting, and you're right. I mean, some people, you're not sure, you didn't even know they were on the tour. I mean, you may not have even heard of them, unless maybe you watched a web.com maybe 3-4 years ago, you know. And
those are the guys who are not bringing people through the gates.
Right.
And use one of our phrases, those guys don't put bums on seats.
Nope. No, you're right. Well, John, I am unfortunately out of time. We had to make this quick and sweet due to some technical difficulties this morning, and it's a real shame because it's always a pleasure to have you on the show, and we always seem to have a good bit of banter. So I apologize for the difficulties, but thank you for joining me for a short but sweet visit.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right. Take care. All right, that was John Huggin from Golf World Magazine, and or online, I should say. That's it. So sorry for the short but sweet episode, folks, but we'll be back for next week for the last show of the season. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
Well, there's a fire burning on the inside of my soul. And it started